Your 22 pistol, you might have the right to keep and bear it. But that doesn't mean you have the right to make it. That doesn't mean you have the right to talk to other people about making it.
This is Cody Wilson, the crypto anarchist best known for developing the Liberator, a 3D printable gun that was downloaded 100,000 times in 2 days. Now he's got a Bitcoin project called Dark Wallet. Cody's all about DIY weaponry and untraceable money. If you're Chuck Schumer, he's the devil incarnate. If you're a libertarian, well, he's just another Baudrillard-quoting badass. But to everyone else, Cody Wilson is an enigma wrapped inside the barrel of a 3D-printed semi-automatic AR-15. Reason TV will try to get to the bottom of the enigma, if not the barrel, over the next half hour. Join us.
Hi, I'm Todd Cranin here for Reason TV, and I am here with Cody Wilson, and it's great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Cody, you've been described as a troll, as a genius, as a provocateur, as a champion of the Second Amendment, and as one of the 15 deadliest people on the face of the earth by Wired magazine. I'm curious, before you started this business of 3D printing guns, were you prepared for the intensity of the media's reaction to you and your work?
I expected when we started what we did that everything that could be said would be said about us, from sociopathic, dangerous, homicidal maniacs. Look, I expected a level of hyperbole. I did, and I thought that there was a certain conceptual Rubicon that I had passed. And after that point, that I would have given myself over to being characterized and basically unemployable and permanently the kind of clown of digital libertarianism for the rest of my life. It was quite a risk to take. We made this decision in full abandon, right? In this abyssal place where we're like, look, is it even possible to do this? I don't know, but we went on the record trying to do it. So you're probably going to be a failure and regarded as a charlatan and a freak and some kind of idiot forever. But we thought, well, there's just enough of a chance that it is possible and worth doing and that it could really be some game-changing level stuff that I went for it. And that's the thing, for many, many months, I had to risk being permanently labeled this ridiculous person. And I'm probably always going to be that. But to the important people, to our audience and to other people who are listening, we signaled something very meaningful. And it took about a year to get there. And it's a year of humility, and it's a year of being made the most awful person and a monster. And you play into it because they carry your water. But yes, on the inside, you're this is crazy. And it's a very, very hard thing to do. Did I see it coming? Yes. I didn't know it would come to this degree, the degree that it has. And I'm lucky and I'm fortunate in the fact that I put a team together and we ended up doing some of the things we needed to do. So I have legitimacy to do more things. But it was extremely risky on a very personal level.
And what is the current state of Defense Distributed? Are you still in the business of printing designs for 3D guns?
Defense Distributed is still very much interested in being a digital arms publisher, a publisher for the Files for Digital Armament. And we've got Alan Gura, we've got a nice legal team, we're really interested in having that fight insofar as it can be had in this legal field to be that company again. But for the moment, this company can't publish files in the clear, into the clear net, without being subjected to the most awful government, coercion. So we've done other things. I've opened up a second front on Bitcoin. I'm studying release of this Dark Wallet software into the internet. And then we're looking at doing some more prototyping and kind of talking about it and showing it, even if we can't release the files.
Okay, I'd love to get into the whole Dark Wallet concept, and we'll get to that eventually. But I was curious, I thought you were actually stopped from circulating guns.
So the United States State Department has actually kind of asserted intellectual property control over the kinds of data I've generated, and specifically they claim that they are the final authority or the only authority on publication of that data into the public domain. So an essential part of my project, which was the publication component, has been, for the moment, squelched for a year now, completely squelched without explanation. I can continue to develop files and maybe even put those up online in a way that you can see them, but I can't let you download them on the internet right now.
Tell me a little bit about the conditions under which they were squelched.
Oh, yeah, let's do it, man. Well, so a lot of people consider the fact that because they can go buy an AR-15 at Walmart, that this is some material confirmation that they have the right to keep and bear arms. Well, in fact, there's a Cold War legal regime that's been constructed while everyone was kind of asleep and waving the flag. Basically, the United States State Department, through its Political Military Bureau of Affairs, asserts monopoly privilege over all privately and publicly generated technical data related to guns, even related to the maintenance of guns, from class one munitions up all through all the military stuff. So your 22 pistol, you might have the right to keep and bear it in some material sense, but that doesn't mean you have the right to make it. That doesn't mean the right you have the right to talk about making it. That doesn't mean you have the right to talk to other people about making it. You see, they assert control at every one of these levels, and at any liberal court will say, well, I'm seeing keep and bear here, sir, in the text of the Second Amendment. Prove to me you have the right to talk about or make this weapon. This is the task posed to us.
But that actually sounds more like a First Amendment issue, right? If it's about talking about it.
Funny how that works in the end. That's right, yeah. Defense distributed has, and I think especially in the future will, kind of merge these issues. First and Second Amendment now seem almost inextricably related at a certain kind of level, of a fundamental level of publication.
Now, some technology companies like Lavabit, of which I'm sure you know, have chosen to actually shut down in the face of more government restrictions and regulations. But you've actually done the opposite in some way. You've gone, you went a great deal to comply with a lot of the rules. So for example, the Undetectable Firearms Act, you actually modified your gun design to make it comply with that. And you actually went as far as going for a license to manufacture guns. And I'm curious, why did you, given your branding as an anarchist, why go in that direction?
The legal labyrinth that we were trying to navigate actually ends up ending at some unfinished rooms in 922, in Title 18, related to firearm manufacturing. There's an Undetectable Firearms Act, but it actually has no guiding regulations in the CFR. It was just one of these fake laws passed in the 80s. And because the nature of law is this kind of general roof of security, we thought that if we were to just prototype these guns without some type of a nominal licensing or some type of nominal check, that it would just give the excuse to DOJ or ATF to kind of bust in the door and accuse us of something the moment this all hit the media. Of course, I was right in my intuition. The moment it hit the media, they did something. So we didn't want to give them something that was maybe more immediately available, ATF powers to come in and tell us we've made illegal weapons. The thing that we did then, even though there is a way that I think you can make Liberator pistols, Title I, you don't need a license. I tried to show other people how to do that, to give us maximal coverage, the best potential at putting these into the internet. I got a license, and then I took the most conservative approach to manufacturing, quote, undetectable weapons, which was to just have a detectable piece of metal in all of our prototype frames.
I've read, though, that the piece of metal is easily removed. Is that true?
Oh, sure. I mean, any liberal is like, but you can take the piece of metal out. Well, I mean, yeah, but we epoxy it in there because the law is like, it needs to be an integral part. So, I mean, we box it up in there. But of course, you can take the metal out. It's funny to me that like some liberals are like hyper lucid in certain moments. They're like, oh my God, the metal is removable. You know, well, you know, so is a magazine from you know, like they're selective.
Would you get the sense that they don't actually know much about guns when they ask questions?
Yeah, no one cares. I mean, no one knows, no one cares. Think progress and everyone banded on this Chuck Schumer moment where there was like, oh my God, it's a loophole. Certain gun components can't be made of metal. What? You know, like we need to make gun components essentially metal and freeze the technology. And, you know, they have no business even being in this situation. I mean, it's so ridiculous. Like a whole class of people can now determine like what represents essential or necessary technology or some kind of essential platonic form of technology, which needs to be like the continued plateau of this development. No, instead, because of the generalized paradigm of security, we have to freeze gun technology where it is so they can match the kind of security norms that we have.
And you're all about showing how that's actually impossible in the real world.
Oh, of course, yeah, and not just showing it, but kind of like, you know, making that world and forcing that crisis.
You say you've been surveilled by the federal government, and I'm wondering, A, how do you know that, and B, what is that like?
Well, we know we've been surveilled in very obvious ways, because we've invited the state into our lives in different components, right? I have to have the ATF, FBI people come in and do interviews. I'm a Dun & Bradstreet registered manufacturer, one of our subsidiaries. I mean, an exporter. We have to do interviews for that. I mean, the government has, it's this process where you invite it all into your life and you subject yourself to these investigations, you know, fingerprinting, all this kind of stuff. And then, yes, slowly it was confirmed to us that we were being monitored by Department of Homeland Security. This was back in February of 2013. Now, can I prove that to you right now? I can say something that would probably convince you.
let's hear it.
Well, I've said it a few times in the media, and I don't want to out our guy, but we had a guy who was former military, had some connections higher up. See, I don't really want to give this guy away, but it was obvious to us through my connection, third hand. He was saying, he was only helping my engineer, John. He had never even met me. But one of his superiors called him up and was like, what's this I hear about you being in a firearms investigation, right? They had mapped my network. They had mapped the guys helping John. And this guy got the tip off and told John, yeah, by the way, the Senate had approved an investigation of Defense Distributed and its activities. I believe that. There's no way I can prove that that's true, but I believe it. Little material things, though. There was an undercover cop outside my house for like 2 months back, right before the Liberator days. And of course, like when we would check our server logs, you know, DHS and DOJ would just sit on our servers almost all day. It was weird reading these server logs all the time. So we knew for quite a while, for many months, that we were the interesting object of study for many, many different government organizations. That doesn't stop what you're doing, but it conditions it to a degree. So we were quite worried with the development of Liberator that there would might just be some assertion of sovereignty, like there might be a national security letter right after we develop a prototype or something telling us, hey, don't put this in the public domain. So it actually kind of, it changed our thinking in the very end, changed how we prototype. We prototype very quickly, and the very first one we had working, we immediately put into the public domain to prevent the kind of assertion of control.
But it wasn't enough to just fingerprint you and subject you to, you know, periodic searches, actual.
Well, making guns in this country is, you know, serious business, like to them. And of course, they would rather you not do it. That's part of the aesthetic nature of this. Like, to baptize yourself into these processes is to slow you down, is to make you do less. And of course, don't make more than 50 guns, because then you pay a higher tax. And don't make more than $500,000 in revenue, because then you pay a much higher tax. My lawyers tell me things all the time, like, well, look, when you go out there, show some contrition, because it doesn't, like, no, it, who knows how many different federal agencies are looking at you and your disposition, and, you know, be good. You know what I mean? This is like the coaching that I get from the people that I pay them to tell me to stop doing what I'm doing. You know what I mean? Like, that's extremely frustrating.
Can we talk a little bit about the Liberator, and what is it? What motivated you to design it, and what's going on with it today?
The Liberator is the fulfillment of what we called the WikiWeapon Project in the beginning. When I went to the internet to ask for people's money, I was saying, I think we could 3D print a gun. If we could do that, we would publish the files for this gun, and then anyone could 3D print the gun. And it wasn't just a raw technical achievement. I like couched it in all this political rhetoric about, look, it's a signal, you know, of the future we imagine, a kind of counter template for what distributed manufacture means. It means everyone would have access to the means of production. Everyone would be able to print guns. It's a kind of like antithetical critique, not just a critique, but collapse of this progressive idea of how guns would be kind of like channeled to us through legacy manufacturers and the FFL system checked by the NRA and institutional mediation. Gun production to us didn't mean institutional mediation. All would have access or none would, you know? And the revolution was real. Everyone would have access to guns. So we packaged it in a very symbolic package. The Liberator was, it takes its namesake from a psychological operation that the old CIA, the OSS developed for World War II. This was the Liberator pistol drop that was supposed to happen over occupied Europe. Civilian resistance were going to get access to single-shot pistols, and this was supposed to like somehow unnerve the occupying forces to some degree. Oh, anyone might have a gun, you know? You kind of baptize the whole like civilian population into this suspicion, you know. Oh, anyone could express their latent criminality or will to resist. They didn't do it in the end. The Allies didn't do it in the end because they didn't have the nerve. I really think that's the reason. It would make pacification on their end that much more important, because let's face it, we're dealing with someone who'd have to occupy after the occupiers. So I took a page from Badiou, and Badiou says to create historical events, often there is an element of repetition. You rehabilitate some failed previous historical moment and you kind of bring it to its completion. There's some uniqueness in its historical poetry when you can have moments like this. So I took the Liberator moment and I said, we can do Liberator. The digital allows for a more effective Liberator drop. If the 3D printed pistol is something that's achievable, let's drop it into the internet just like Liberator. But this time, it was this paraphysical kind of science fiction nightmare where the logic of the West, of the great Western planners, was returning to attack them, you know, instead of the Axis powers. The United States was, we dropped the Liberator on the United States and the other Western powers, you know, the gun control regimes. I did it, I spliced in these frames of World War II bombers in the video, you know, and it was effectively dropped, and I considered it a kind of an overbidding, a kind of endless challenge to these states to make their security states real, and of course, they can't.
You said, and I'll just quote you to you, you said that Defense Distributed is, quote, really about anarchism, the transcendence of state, and that's what it's really all about. And I'm curious what you mean by that, about the whole concept of flipping the power dynamic between the oppressed and the oppressor. Explain that.
What's at stake with something like the Liberator is the knowledge and data related to the manufacture of a firearm, even at its most crude and inefficient, right? But it's very important for these nation states, these monopolistic legacy powers, to not let common people have access to that information, because therein lies a certain shift in the equation of the power dynamic. 3D printers are still mostly first world, middle class plus technology. They're kind of everywhere around the world, and so you'll see Liberator videos from all over the world, Brazil, Israel, Ukraine, Finland, people all over the world have printed them out, and this was confirmation that this model was possible. The platform was already diverse or diffuse enough that, okay, what we said was true. This is now a global technology, people can print the guns, and it's a template of thought, it's a template of action. This is how it's always going to be as the printers become more complicated, as digital manufacturing becomes more complex. If you release some of these guns or gun-like implements into the internet, they'll be printed anywhere all the time. So it was at least very strongly suggestive, and I think it was its most potent, not in the physical. Syrian resistance fighters aren't going to be printing out Liberator pistols, unfortunately, but at the moment it's a kind of signal of the subjective nature of the genesis of power itself, that there is nothing to get an intermediate between you and the relationship you have with your computer, your networked printing device, and that this is extremely terrifying in its own right and its own worthy level of symbolic violence that outstrips any real violence you could do with the Liberator anyway.
The whole program, in a sense, is designed to what you call force a crisis, in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
That ultimately liberates people, that creates more freedom. Right? I mean, that's in a nutshell. Is that an accurate way of talking about it?
Yeah, so I'm often kind of accused of a certain like naivete for thinking like, well, what you're doing you think somehow leads to freedom, and don't you think in the end you're actually the ultimate kind of excuse for the greater constrictions of freedom? I think it's already playing out, and in fact, I think the legislative outcomes would have been worse if I hadn't been me, actually, if it had been somebody else, but I don't believe that what we're doing leads to changing the facts on the ground to like a more free situation, a more objectively free situation anytime soon. I believe that these powers, especially as their survival, like these nation states, like when Bitcoin begins to kind of sap all the great powers, they don't just kind of wither away and the situation doesn't get immediately better for no reason. They cling on to every last bit of power. The legal kind of modus operandi is the confinement of the outside. The legal regime says that immediately that there is nothing outside of it, and so you give it a kind of complex new, like a dynamic new network structure, and it says, well, there's nothing outside of me, and then it reaches to try to contain this, to try to contain Bitcoin, to contain 3D printed guns. And yet we all understand in a very functional, practical way, there's no way that this confinement can successfully happen. This legal encapsulation, it's not effectively possible. So it's fun to kind of challenge the state to greater and greater levels of its own hyperstatism, right? Challenge it in its own kind of regulatory bureaucratic imagination. And in Baudrillard and these other people that like really influenced DD, we say to challenge it successfully enough leads to its own suicide, its own collapse from its own weight.
Why is that?
Any system like on the verge of totality is also like simultaneously on the verge of like immediate probable subversion. There can be no total internet systems that can't also be the system that delivers the Liberator to the very, goddamn heart of, everywhere. I mean, it's like, it's this fundamental reversibility of these near total systems. There's a certain kind of like logic to it, an extreme logic, a fatal strategy.
A fatal strategy?
Baudrillard calls it like fatal theory. Understanding that like concepts like anti-fragility and some of these new network ways of thinking or like mimetic concepts like the Streisand effect, the greater the government or authorities try to break down information or censor it or harbor it or constrict it, the greater its potentiality to kind of spread everywhere. I mean, this is what the new network effects are. Our minds and like in diaspora across like spread across these networks, they're leading to different and new kinds of strategies for effectively evading not just like sovereign observation, but effective means of state control and gatekeeping. The internet has changed some things. And even if I'm accused of being like internet-centric and utopian, like the internet clearly makes available new strategies, Bitcoin being like the most obvious and incredible. And then you can have these interesting phenomena like releasing the 3D printed gun into the internet forever.
So let's talk about subversive strategies. Speaking of that, we'll talk about Dark Wallet. Can you explain what it is?
It's an in-browser extension, Bitcoin in the browser. And that space is actually heated up before or right after we did our fundraiser. A number of companies have moved that direction. Dark Wallet's not a company, but we're going to be releasing basically our first best package of Bitcoin software that can do stealth addresses for you, can do a version of money laundering called CoinJoin that we think can be done in a nice way. It'll handle the blockchain in a non-awkward fashion through a separate kind of server set. And it should, in every way, just kind of, we think, or should, embolden the digital libertarian to carry out more of his affairs in Bitcoin. Or, let's say, someone in the system D to do more of their activity in Bitcoin and not worry about, you know, being in the regulatory tables of power and worrying about, you know, having a bank account or worrying about being investigated and found out. There's a number of startup projects in Bitcoin that are not just kind of carrying the water or apologizing for the legacy banking systems, but are like actively working with regulators to tie software into their databases and to triangulate identities and to create whitelists and green lists or to create public blockchains. What's so insane is that a lot of the people, a lot of the first gen, second gen people that were connected to Bitcoin, I'm using gen very loosely, some of the first people on the ground with Bitcoin technology were ostensibly libertarian, or at least, you know, should have been. And then there's kind of this furious rush to the East and West Coast, either to cozy up to the financial powers in New York or to get some VC money out on the West Coast, to just kind of like paper over the cracks in the old institutional banking system, the old money system, and to say, to tell this kind of story with Bitcoin that like, oh, well, Bitcoin is what we've been waiting for, to kind of perfect what had been at this point kind of incomplete. My advice to people at this Bitcoin conference yesterday was, no, that system is very much in disrepair, and what is falling should be pushed. You know, it's Bitcoin represents the question mark on this system. Let's go all the way the other direction. Don't apologize and make, you know, get money to make up this system and to kind of prop it up for a while. Abolish this system. Go in a different development direction. The dark wallet, Black Bloc anarchists are pursuing an alternative development direction, which reifies a certain kind of nightmare that the security state had back in the crypto wars, that there is a go dark problem, that oh my God, one day all this activity that we monitor might just somehow disappear from us. It might run from us. How can we pursue it?
So in a way, Dark Wallet is about having Bitcoin ultimately live up to its promises.
Exactly, yeah. It's about what's the kind of Bitcoin we actually want as a digital libertarian tool. Right now it's a pure technology of the self. It has none of the qualities it's kind of purported to have. I'm not criticizing it, I'm just saying like it's worse than cash, you know, every transaction is permanently kind of investigatable, and most people don't use, they don't reuse addresses and stuff, and so it's actually kind of much more a technique of your own surveillance and binding to external power than you might imagine. It's like, and these Bitcoin ATMs have biometrics and stuff. I mean, it's this kind of perverse way of talking about the money of the future when really it's just like the perfect money of your own subjection.
And how's the new effort being funded? How's that going?
Well, we raised like six figures online in crowdfunding. We've gotten kind of good at crowdfunding over the year. So we raised a bunch of money in crowdfunding and we funded it for the last few months.
Doing well?
Yeah, it's good. I don't need any more money. I think we're good. We'll have a release in April. I've timed it with an ABC Nightline piece, so it's all the money. You know.
Well, hell of a way to, I guess any publicity is good publicity, right?
I mean, yes, of course, I agree, but the strategy goes a bit deeper. I mean, you mentioned crisis forcing. For me, the level of rhetoric has ratcheted up to such a successful degree in Bitcoin. We have Joe Manchin, who, it's not an accident, also wanted to ban our assault weapons in Manchin Toomey, now saying we should ban Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Chuck Schumer, Dianne Feinstein, and Joe Manchin, who are these people? What the hell is going on? And why do all these issues, like this, the muscular defense of the welfare, security, warfare state, the banning of Bitcoin and assault weapons, all converge in these people in these very strange ways? It's mystifying. But now that there's this level of rhetoric about banning Bitcoin completely because Russia and China have, and because I don't want Americans to suffer risk, it's this perfect, like, fertile bed to kind of throw in this ABC Nightline piece in prime time, where like mom and pop and everybody minding their own business kind of gets a taste of Bitcoin as like, you know, the currency of the apocalypse. And oh my God, what are these digital libertarians doing? And the symbolic violence again, it's something like Liberator. I want the very next day Chuck Schumer to be out and be like, this is ridiculous.
But it appeals to a certain contrarian streak in
you.
Oh,
man.
Like, well.
Yeah. Well, everyone's in Bitcoin, especially, and the Bitcoin people deserve this. Everyone is trying to avoid the catastrophe. And this is the episode of the Bitcoin Foundation. This is the moral lesson that is Charlie Shrem's life at this point. everyone's trying to avoid the catastrophe by what? Creating it. Oh, well, in order to avoid the terrible regulatory outcome, we should go become the regulatory interface. And at least if we tell the congressional people how to regulate it, they'll regulate it better than if somebody else filled the vacuum, filled the void. Well, no, man. The lesson from, again, Foucault, Kafka, the 20th fucking century, is that you can't participate in these processes and not create that outcome. That's the kind of like stupid, ironic outcome that happens. And so every Bitcoiner after San Jose has been the implement of the destruction of this currency, its co-option, and ultimately like its grand regulatory, you know, confinement.
So you've got a big book deal with Simon and Schuster?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I sold a proposal in the end of 2013, actually. It's weird because there was this very bimodal reception, right? It's either like, this guy's crazy, this is terrible, or this guy's extremely interesting, shut up and take our money, you know?
What's the book going to be about?
Okay, so like, Catcher in the Rye meets the digital apocalypse.
That sounds great, but I have no idea what it means.
So the excuse for telling the gun was, of course, the Liberator pistol and Defense Distributed's, you know, incursions into the gun debate, you know, the historical grounding too of the post Sandy Hook fight, and then kind of our travels and all the strange communities that we met along the way, the communities of neo-reaction in San Francisco, the Dark Enlightenment guys, the Zeitgeist people, the weird Singularity people, the anarchist hotbeds in Europe, the strange expats, the nation-state games going on, the spies being kind of funded and counterfunded, and all of these people, we kind of ran through these different layers, were always around us. We had to like meet, when you do an extreme project, you meet extreme people. So I mean, this is an excuse to investigate these people's frame of thought. I want to criticize David Brooks. I want to bring up the post-Snowden moment. I want to have a generational divide between we, the kind of despairing millennials who are so much apolitical but also like capable, versus the baby boomers who are close to achieving medical immortality and are the greatest sinners who have lived on the earth.
Sounds dangerously close to a manifesto to me. I don't know.
Yeah, but I want to do it novelistically. You know, I don't want to like just kind of write it out. That's boring. Hopefully, it will be a stepping stone toward a young radical's radicalization. Maybe it'll be in the library of certain digital libertarians in the future. I mean, I want to explain how we did what we did, our intuitions about the society of the spectacle, certain things we learned about the media, certain ways we were able to play the state and its institutions against itself that were like were real and happened and were kind of almost outrageous and difficult to believe. But I'm much more interested in the storytelling in a kind of Baudrillardian, you know, postmodern visual sense, you know, where everything takes on like historical poetics, and I mean, it's extremely pretentious.
But you're selling it very well.
But if you package it just right,
and the hope is what to inspire the next generation of Cody Wilson.
Mostly to tell a really good story, man. I hope it's worthy of the title of, you know, literature in the end.
So Cody Wilson, it's a pleasure to have you.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you for the question.